I just thought that might be of interest at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Flo. That was very good up here. Also presenting the other side of the coin in some aspects. Okay, I think if anybody in the audience has questions right now for the panel or anything they'd like to discuss, let them go ahead.
Yeah, I want to discuss the cost thing. Robert, you've read the technical appendix. Are there any cost estimates given on those projects? I haven't read them.
Yeah, they do them all.
They do them all. And what are their figures roughly around per megawatt?
Oh, yeah, that's kind of it's a pretty roughshod way of looking at it, but the bigger the plant, the lower the cost per kilowatt hour.
Right.
So you have a small one, like the dam on the proposed on the Teslin River, was I think about $1,300 per kilowatt or something. And a really big one, like say the High Granite Canyon, it drops down to 800. To put that in context, you can buy, a little Briggs & Stratton 1 kilowatt generator for well under $1,000, I think.
Well, unfortunately, there's nobody from NCPC here, but my big question on the whole Sigma thing and just the way they're presenting hydro as the most, economic alternative is the fact that they came up with a similar argument in 73 at the AJAC hearings. And they presented us in 73 with a figure of $15 million. Now, apparently, I hear the estimates are getting up to around $33 million. Now, sure, we've had some inflation between 73 and 75, but not in the neighborhood of 50% each year. I don't think there's been that. So, I really question the credibility of NCPC's cost figures before the fact, considering their past performance, after the fact. I really, it's too bad there's nobody from NCPC here. I can, Mr. Mooney's not here. I can ask him on that.
Would anybody in the audience like to comment on that, actually? Anybody feel differently about it?
Yeah. From readings at school and stuff, the Army Corps of Engineers down in the States, this is something that's just being revealed now in all their cost-benefit analysis. After the dam's been constructed, nobody's really gone back and added up exactly how much it actually cost and compared it with the estimate. And they're finding out that in most of their dams, the costs have just spiraled right up, so it's gone way out of proportion.
Following that same example, the Army Corps of Engineers has got a very bad reputation for development, by the way, but it's an internationally bad. I don't know if NCPC considers it to be in the same but they have doubled or tripled in their estimates of the original cost, always the length that the dam was going to last. Besides the actual cost of it, that was the other end, how long it would last. They doubled or tripled that length, inevitably. There are dams that were supposed to last to the end of the century that have been folded up for 10 years now, that still to do, etc. So, you can pull little fiddles in the equation at both ends. Something to worry about, for sure. If you want to just worry about that narrow version of economics, there's just in that alone, there's a lot to worry about.
That's one of the advantages, Mr. Chairman, of having your hand in the public purse, because it doesn't matter what the ultimate cost is. The money is going to be available at low interest, and the taxpayer will pay for it. You're not a private corporation having to show a profit.
Very true. Yes?
They environment damage on the Five Fingers project would be very small. If they developed the cattle ranching possibilities between Midway and Minto, they'd be able to raise more moose than there is in that valley, because I know that country.
Not more sand.
There's less than a quarter of 1% of the moose in that valley. And even building the dam wouldn't reduce it to any great extent. And on top of that, if you moved all the black topsoil and the valley bottom out onto the high land, then you could really grow something.
Anybody like to
respond to that?
Well, the salmon, for example, would certainly be affected by the dam on the Yukon River. And if I'm not doubting the possibilities for agriculture in the Yukon, I think that's a whole other issue that's been put down on one of the people that don't really know the past prospects. But in this particular case, we're talking not strictly sort of the economic and protein value or whatever of what's lost, which can be replaced by agriculture, but of its intrinsic value as wildlife. It's not strictly whether you can replace what would be there on the protein value of the fish or the meat by agriculture, but it's what that wildlife means as a in and of itself, what it means to people, and what it means to the whole world, really.
If this idea of running the overflow down to Yukon Crossing, instead of letting you go down over the dam, if that saves the fish, it might be a big step ahead in conserving our fish properly.
I'm sure that idea would work.
I think they've found that most diversions involving fish have very little success. I think.
Yeah, but they've never tried anything like
25%.
They've never tried anything like that before. And that's what Mr. Moon said. He said that was an idea that he'd never thought of before, but he said, I'm sure it works.
Yeah, I was wondering why the experts hadn't thought of it before.
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions?
Martin, could we just follow along that line a bit? What has the percentage of success been for the fish ladder, for example, here at this dam?
I think if I can quote from roughly what the fisheries officer said, that by 1980 there would be no fish going through the dam. 1989. And that the Mayo Run was completely cut off by the Mayo Dam. And that I think he said the success rate of fingerlings passing back through was between 5% and 25%.
In your paper tonight, I believe there's a report through some of the native people who lived at Marsh Lake, and the fish at the McClintic was quite a flourishing thing, with a large population of Indians living around, although the 1918 flu epidemic upset the status quo. But after that dam was put in 1922, there's been the fish population. There used to be a salmon trap or salmon catch back 10 years ago in my lifetime, and that has gone down. So now I believe Johnny Joe, who has been a resident on that from the turn of the century, I think he picked up 2 salmon 2 years ago, and he points it all back to the time that the White Pass Dam was put in 1922. There has been a steady deterioration even prior to the White Horse Dam. So these things have to be taken into account with regards to your life, of your wildlife.
Is that
nobody else is asking a question. I just sort of want to comment on one thing. It's sort of more an opinion, is that I see a number of times the thing, opinion expressed, that the reason we need more hydroelectric is we've got to phase out diesel because of shortage of oil and everything else. However, I think if you draw, you play the game of drawing graphs, you'll probably notice at the same time the Yukon hydro consumption increased drastically. Along with it, the petrochemical consumption increased drastically. And unless there's a very comprehensive electrification program, like electric cars, et cetera, another hydro dam and the increase in development in megawatt will not help us conserve oil resources, because I think we'll just see, along with it, X number, so much more development, so much more machinery, so many more vehicles. I think we're going to probably end up in the same sort of exponential growth curve, which is causing very serious economic problems in southern Canada and especially the USA. And like my opinion is simply that, if with Ajax and the White Horse Rapids, we can manage we should start putting a lot more energy towards, you know, like mental energy or whatever other energy we have towards, you know, making do what we can to stave off that exponential curve which is threatening the rest of the world. It's just an opinion throwing out.
Chairman, if I can pick up on that one, I'm not worrying about conserving the supply for the rest of the world. I'm worrying about the cost of providing hydropower here with half of it generated by diesel units. And their cost is skyrocketing. My point was that it is cheaper to use the hydro energy available than to import diesel fuels to get your energy. And as you know, the prices are going to keep on increasing for imported diesel fuel. So it, as a consumer, it doesn't make sense to keep on using diesel if we can use hydro.
Well, there's one thing that I throw in about that, and that's that, getting back to that talk about spiraling costs, there is an enormous capital cost associated with the dam. And the cost of everything that goes into a dam, to build a dam, is increasing. The labor, etc. And at a much higher rate, right at this moment, than the price of oil is increasing. At a very much higher rate. But besides that, a great deal of what you see in terms of the cost, that capital cost, is can actually be traced back to an energy cost. You have, in some cases, 200 and some square miles of land to be cleared. You have several 100,000 tons of fill and several 100 or a million tons of fill and several 100,000 tons of concrete to be trucked or shipped in and out. You have thousands of workers to provide homes and electrical lights and heat, etc., while the dam project is being built. When you really stop to look at it, it would be interesting if you took that, which is a you know, in terms of looking at hydro as the sort of panacea for ever-increasing energy consumption in the world, besides the environmental cost, besides the dollar value cost, electrical energy does not even come without an energy cost. And it's a very, very high energy cost in this case. And it's, I'm not sure, but it would be interesting if we could just find out what that was and see how many years it would be that that dam would have to be in operation before that energy cost was paid back. But,
one thing I have to point out, in all fairness, is that the cost of the construction of that dam would be borne by the people of Canada.
Right.
And I'm bearing the cost of the fuel.
So what we're asking for
is that we... There is a cost that we as Yukon consumers, if we remain in the community beyond 1980, will have to bear. And that's the cost of that electricity, whether the people of Canada pay for building the dam or not. And I hear the planners saying that there are two ways of approaching the availability of energy for economic development. And one thing is to plan in terms of the observed curves of growth and try and make sure that when you need the power, the aggregate power is there. And these are two alternatives that are similar, so simplistic as to be sort of black and white. The other side of the coin is dumping a whole bunch of hydro in the hopes that someone will consume it, which would mean, in the case of the Yukon, that relatively larger amounts of kilowatts made available here in the Yukon would be an incentive to the mining industry to consider the development of deposits which are not now necessarily economical. Because if they knew the power was there and they knew the rate was fixed, it would help them in their planning. Traditionally in the Yukon, hydroelectric development or electric development in general, because of course, as folks point out, half of it seems to be diesel, has simply been provided to meet the existing load, and there has been no thought planning to funding hydro development on a scale that would make it attractive to bring in industry. Now, suddenly, I read in the newspaper and I hear I seem to get the impression via this that this is an alternative which is being considered. Now,
what can happen in that situation is, if this, the mining economy is a boom or bust economy, it depends on all sorts of factors over which none of us have any influence, the condition of the world, the markets, on all sorts of things that have no relationship to the Yukon. If they fund a dam on the basis of the fact that they want some slack to entice the development of primary and secondary industry in the Yukon, and that doesn't occur, we're going to be stuck with a high cost per kilowatt, because we're going to pay for that electricity, whether industry is sucking it up or not. And that's a risk that I don't think that's been very clearly stated, because as far as the costs are concerned, it's the Yukon that's going to consume that electricity. We're not talking about electricity for export yet, which is another alternative as well.
Very good. Anybody feel the same or have a different opinion of that?
Yeah. Well, that was my question. I was going to ask you if the whole project hadn't been in mind to export electricity with kind of that it was.
Would anybody like to comment on that?
I don't. It's never exported. I don't think it's considered in there at all.
There's one thing that was hinted at, and it's not been talked about in the Sigma report, and that's that aluminum smelter, which is a roundabout way. You know, it's a red herring, but something like that is a roundabout way of exporting power. You come right down to it.
Well, what about electrification of white passes?
I was just listening to somebody from CN talking about electrifying CN on Michael Enright's show today, and he said it was a long way off before they could see that, and it would probably be in the major use centers, but the capital cost would be so immense that it would they end up just not seeing the right side of the equation, the cost equation yet.
That's
so
one of the next
studies. Okay. Yeah. So I think that's another red herring, because if that's the case for CN and the high density areas of Canada, you know, I doubt White Pass is going to be able to bear that capital cost.
It's partly CN too. It's a kind of a fossilized company.
Not ready for these puns.
Would anybody else like to comment on the question over here about is it growth for excess power?
See, I'd just like something clarified. What is the relationship of the Northern Canada Power Commission to the federal government? Like, is it a Crown corporation? So they have license to take taxpayers' money, build a dam, and then try and make a profit out of it. Is that basically it?
Yes, I think so. I think they can even make a lot of it.
If they make any profit out of it, rates are supposed to go down. That's the theory of a Crown such as NCPC. Right?
Yes, that's right. And
yeah.
So
if there is a profit made, which there has been at this Whitehorse plant, the rates are supposed to be lowered. Recent changes.
In that district.
Yeah, in this district, not in the NWC. Recent changes in the NCPC Act in Parliament are they through yet now?
Yes.
Or are they still in committee?
It's been passed.
They're through. Caused a great deal of discussion, and you've probably heard of briefs and appearances by Northerners at those hearings, because we had a few things to say about where these profits should or should not go, and how much NCPC should be allowed to spend without some authorizing body keeping an eye on the amount. They've eliminated all there used to be over 50,000, they had to get a special commission for whatever, but no more. You know, it's carte blanche. The whole thing is carte blanche all the way from here to breakfast on the taxpayer. So another thing that Northerners were asking for was more representation on the NCPC board of directors, because until now there has been the deputy minister of the Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development as chairman of that board, plus senior civil servants from the department, and etc. We have now effected that change, and for the first time this year, both of the territorial councils, NWT and Yukon, will be nominating a member of that board. And also, the chairman has been named, and he's a Northerner, the commissioner of the Yukon. So you will have three Northerners on that board of directors for the first time in history. at the deputy minister level too, let me say. I'm confused, you guys.
No, I'm unfortunately you've clarified it very well. I certainly do not think that much of having developmentalists totally on that board. And I would bring up the statement made by the other gentleman from the game department that I see that as a definite conflict of interest. I mean, you know, the commissioner is going to vote for development because it's going to be a feather in his cap, let's face it, you know. I don't consider the commissioner being on the board any points in our favor.
But he's a northerner, that's one point.
No,
yeah, but he also is really into development, and that's another point.
If I could just say, if you have that feeling, then your action is clear. Your course is very simple. What you do is lobby to get your kind of representative named by territorial council to the board, right?
Are they voting members on the board, or are they just representatives?
Oh, no, they will be executive members of the board.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice if he was an elected member of the council.
No, I don't think that's in the terms of reference. He's simply nominated by council to be on the NCPC.
Can groups such as this make recommendations?
Certainly. Recommend to your territorial member who you think would be the right person to be on the NCPC board.
When you say they're nominated, who okays it?
Is the commissioner again at the final say on this, or is it the elected members? This is the main question.
No, I think if it's a specific recommendation from council, I don't see how that...
Mm-hmm. That's how I understood it, yes.
No, I'm getting at the chairman, which is not an elected northerner.
Right.
There never have been elected anything on that board till now. They've been senior civil service, and this is a breakthrough to get elected members on there and elected members from the north. So, I mean, it may be crumbs from the table, but at least crumbs and you've got to start somewhere. I think it's a breakthrough. I really think it's a breakthrough.
I think Matt's in the back of the question.
Well, all the appointments are made by Gil Buchanan, the Minister of the Development and the Peace of Wall Street and the Development Program. But until now, he's had a deputy minister, another civil servant, and a citizen at large. Just some political matter, you know. But now all the appointments will still be strictly appointments from Buchanan, and he's not obligated to accept any recommendations.
Well, I think he's very foolish of him to ignore them.
Well, yeah, but there is still an obligation.
Yeah. There's one thing with regards to all of this, I think it's been brought up by several people, that it seems that more and more a tradition is becoming evolved, of being evolved, of the Minister of Northern Development sort of running the North through consulting firms, you know, consulting firms that don't account to anybody within the regions within which they work, consulting firms that don't even have to identify themselves, consulting firms that don't have to publicize their costs. Consulting firms that don't have to, for instance, announce themselves prior to starting, and so on. And I think that we need to form some kind of a committee in this territory, which will, first of all, register all these bloody consultant firms, and that will demand that will police them to a certain extent, that will insist that people from within the territory that have equivalent experience and equivalent knowledge and equivalent qualifications be considered first for the hiring for these kinds of jobs, and so on and so on and so on. I would like that committee to be formed tonight, if that's possible, or at least come out of this particular thing.
Well, if I may say, Mr. Chairman, our friend has just stolen my first three questions, which will be on the order paper next week in Territorial Council, because I have been building up a head of steam on this for some time now, and the last two or three ha-ha reports that I've read, I mean in other departments of the territorial government, have been absolutely atrocious, and I'm not informed enough to even know how atrocious they are. Even to me, they're atrocious and uninformed and poorly done.
No, don't put yourself down.
I want to know A, are all these surveys put out to tender first?
Exactly.
Who makes the decision that who will do the study? That's the first question. And I know, I'm positive that at least two of the studies I'm thinking of could have been done, and one at least was done, by sitting in the reading room at the UConn archives and assessing the material already available on that topic. And we have people qualified in the UConn to sit in that reading room and do it without bringing in outsiders at my expense. And you're absolutely right. I don't know if you need a committee from this group, if you want to, fine, but I'm going to ask those questions anyway.
Well, I mean, something has to be done, because, I mean, it's rampant, it's a disease. In fact, it really is.
It's a cancer. I just want to answer that one question. When I asked one department head, how come that outfit got all those to do, oh, well, they were here anyway, so we might as well ask them, you know.
Okay, go.
Two things. There is an obscure ordinance, which is known as the Scientist and Explorers Ordinance, which is virtually impossible to enforce, which states that anyone doing research in the Yukon, it sort of means out in the wilderness doing research. It doesn't really mean social research or historical research, but it could be stretched to imply that they have to register and in fact then deposit their information in some vaguely undefined manner. It would be possible to beef up the intent of that ordinance and create a mechanism whereby it could be enforced. I know that has been discussed at various times in the Territorial Council. Secondly, there is in the works, in planning, something which is likely to take place in several years, which happens to be an Indian Affairs installation, and that is a scientific research laboratory actually situated in Whitehorse, and in a similar manner to the one in Nuvik and the one in somewhere else in the Northwest Territories. This one, however, would be different in that local federal agencies and territorial agencies that would require scientific instrumentation and laboratory space to operate would share it. It would have a tendency to be a focal point for any group that came into the North to do research. In other words, they would have a tendency to use its resources as an office, as background information. And therefore, they would be more visible, and they would be more closely in contact with local researchers. There might be more of a pooling of information and an exchange. But I myself have been talking with various people in the community for a long time, trying to push individuals in the direction of incorporating as a business and consulting directly, because there's tons and tons and tons of money being dumped out on consultation, and there are many, many people in the Yukon who could do a far more adequate job of putting together some of these documents than is now the case. And I think that Mrs. Weyer's question about how these things
go, well, Christ, we could practically live off the
you could.
I mean, really.
Oh, yeah,
you
know, very nice little bit. I think we're getting off the subject.
Yeah, anyway.
Well, there's one thing I'd like to throw in about that consultation thing. That is, in the federal government, has become rampant. It's become scandalous. There's an MP in the burial picking it up in the House now. They, a couple of years ago, passed a thing eliminating a lot of scientific and technical type of man years within the federal civil service. And Department of Supply and Services, whoever handles it, and but at the same time gave an enormous quantity more money than those man years would have cost to be given out to so-called private enterprise research groups, which have turned out to be the civil servants that were doing this job before who quit and now are making twice as much money and as consultants.
Yeah.
That's one little thing, and the other thing is just the general abuse of consulting firms to answer questions that a representative government should look to the people for, and instead of making us feel inadequate to answer what I feel the biggest question, for example, to me about this power project is whether we need the damn thing in the first place, whether we want the type of life it's going to give us. And I feel that I'm adequate, no matter what I know. I don't even have to know how to plug into the wall socket to be able to answer that, because it's just what I feel.
Well, half the time we provide the information anyway. Right. Then
but
well,
because of these consulting firms getting into these things and making our life or what we're doing every day look more complicated than it really is, I think that's undermining the democratic process. But it's not only to just the people. I think that, you know, with the civil service and the consulting firms together, how does the elected representatives keep on top of all this stuff?
Maybe we should at least begin by taxing them, you know, I think that...
Well, at least you can get a business license for
pizza. Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, it was spoken by Dave Mossop's predecessor here in the game department that he admitted that, or he stated that the most of this information came from branches of government that are already operating in their territory, and their recommendation would be that on such a fine that the government department should be... report should be parallel with it to see that they kept on the straight and narrow, because the reports are in our government files and these fellows are just making hay out of going around picking up all this information and writing these reports and getting the 30, 60 or 150,000 out of it.
There's one thing, maybe one small thing that maybe could be said in defense of a consulting operation.
You watch your toes.
Most civil servants are inundated with things to do, and when one of these things come along where a special project comes along, somebody needs this information gathered together, oftentimes government doesn't have a man to do it.
In defense of consultants as well, I worked for a firm of consulting engineers for 3 years, and this firm, I won't mention it because that would be advertising. They were prime geological consultants at the Peace River Dam and also the Mica Dam and so on, and they are engineers in sort of like the classical sense. They have their terms of reference spelled out and they write their report, the terms of reference are there, and they go through and they make their qualified opinions. They said this is our qualified opinion. And they finish up by recommending expenditures here to do this, expenditures there to do this, and so on, all the way through. And then they sign it, and they put their qualifications at the end with a statement saying that we have no monetary interest or whatever in what our conclusions are. And this is what an engineer has been for as long as they've been going, 100 years or so. And this is actually, in some ways, an electrical engineer's report, and yet it's not signed. We don't know who the electrical engineer is. But there are decisions made in there which only an electrical engineer can make, presumably, because they're saying that the cost of the dam would be this and this and this and this, and only an engineer knows those costs. And they are actually recommending, well, they're not recommending expenditures exactly, but they are sort of setting out their opinions as engineers. But again, it's not signed. It's not an engineering report. It seems to me that the Yukon Association of Professional Engineers should take a long, hard look at that and put out a policy paper describing what engineering standards are in consulting reports, and it should be followed.
I would think that such a recommendation from the Professional Association would be welcomed by the territorial government.
Okay, so that deals with the people behind the report and consulting in general. Any more? Any other questions on broader items of concern?
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment to Flo's earlier about the electrification of white pads. Now, I'm not sure about this because I'm not an electrical engineer. However, I believe from what I have in my own reading done on advancements in technology, electrical, otherwise, it may well be possible in 5 or 10 years that the electrification of white pass will be almost a net non-user of power, because when that train full of ore is going down the hill, it's putting power back in the system. And since it's going down a much greater altitude with a larger load than it comes up, it will be, relatively speaking, a very low user with the improvements, such things as flywheel, storage engines, etc., this type of thing. It's just a thing I want to toss out.
Further to that, I remember when the amendments to the NCPC Act were being discussed for assembly in Ottawa, that someone asked the question, well, what about the electrification of the white pass railway? And one of the guys who used to be on the NCPC board said, well, it kind of looks like they'll actually be putting more power
into the system that we'll be taking out, but we're still trying to talk them into it. So.
Okay, Rob, do you happen to know how much actually they'd estimated for things like that?
Well, they said 5 to 15 megawatts, which is an enormous difference. That's like one copper mine versus three. In the load. And I asked them to explain it in a letter, and I got the reply on Monday, and they said, well, we don't know how much freight traffic is going to be on the railway. We don't know whether it's going to CarMax or not. And we said there's a number of things, so that's why they said 5 to 15. But they could have given a firm estimate on the basis of the existing railway and the existing load quite easily, I'm sure.
That was another thing that struck me in the report, breaking down the amount of power generated and by whom and where at the present time. Cassiar Asbestos Clinton Peak property has its own diesel generating system, and they generate as much power there as the Yukon Electric does, according to this report. And obviously it must have been economic for them to install their own diesel equipment for the lifetime of that asbestos mine. And therefore, if that is so, why are we worrying about future mines demanding cheap power? It's just a little question in my mind on that.
The mine manager at Clinton told me that Yukon Electric had done a study and that it was preferable, diesel was preferable.
They were also having to give them
a subsidy. Cassiar? You got the wrong mine. The government wouldn't even build a bridge across the Ruddy River for them. No. The Cassiar Asbestos people invested something like $34 million to bring that Clinton Creek. Yeah. To bring that property into production. The federal government invested something like $3 million. As I recall, those are the figures.
The only thing that I'm aware of that the government did was upgrade the boundary road. The Clinton Creek even built the road up to join to it.
They were not subsidized.
Although it is now a public road.
Anyway, that's getting you off the track, I'm sorry, Martin. But they do generate as much as you can look at it.
I think that was a point that Robert mentioned earlier, actually, that perhaps mines with a short-term life should just look after their own power rather than get the government to provide power for them and through the taxpayers in Canada in general and the whole ecology of the Yukon. Okay,
I'd like to ask Garth a question about the mechanics of decision making. Now, the Science Council of Canada had made specific recommendations which are quoted in the report for hearings to be held at different phases of the project and the development, and also specific recommendations for public participation and public assessment of the projects. Yet the report also states that NCPC are not responsible for the economic growth of the Yukon. Yet I see the commissioner was reported as saying no hydro, no development very recently. Can we demand what rate the Cypress Anvil have from NCPC?
I'm not sure which part of that question. In spite of the remarks that Mrs. Wire quoted and Krachan is making about the questions that would be asked in terms of the development of the Canadian North, I am aware of another document also authored by Mr. Krachan, which is the Department of Indian Affairs Statement of Goals and Objectives for the Development of the Canadian North, which categorically states throughout that the North will be developed for the benefit of the people of Canada. So that's one qualification on decision making. One of the things that fascinated me about Sigma's introduction to the Northern Society was the vehemence with which Northerners told them they didn't believe a word they were hearing from Sigma about public participation, mm-hmm. about about the public's ability to influence anybody's decision making in terms of that report, or in terms of that report influencing any basic resource development decisions that NCPC might make. And I haven't seen anything that would cause me to alter my personal opinion that we have every right to be suspicious of anybody, consultant or otherwise, who claims to involve us in the participant process when we can't get anywhere near the basic questions about resource development, as we've all been mentioning this evening. We're 2 to 3 steps down the line. So the people that came up from Sigma and the people from NCPC who were support to them in terms of these public hearings kept running into this person after person after person who came up to talk to them. You know, we simply don't believe you when we say our opinion makes any difference in your decision making process. And I think that's a fairly realistic approach. In spite of that, in keeping with the remarks that I made earlier, it does have some effect. Climate of public opinion does have some effect in general. And as Mrs. Wired also stated, the specific questions that have been raised, technical questions, have got to be faced. They're now, they've been dredged up by this. Let's face it, NCPC and Sigma have come forward and asked for citizen participation. And having done so, there's no way they can get away from the questions that have been asked. They have to provide answers to them. And some of those may lead into areas which will further alter public opinion to the point where the actual behind-the-scenes decision-making process will be influenced. Maybe. Maybe not. I think you can't do anything but try.
As a specific question, can we demand to know what kind of contract the government has with Cypress Anvil?
Sure, you can demand anything you like.
Yeah.
I don't know why that should have to be unavailable, particularly since they are no longer negotiating it, and it has been in effect for, what, 5 years? My understanding of that contract, and I was not told this by an Anvil official, nor by a government or NCPC official, is that it is not a sweet contract. They are paying more than you and I.
Yeah, I think
we still know what Yukon Electric buying their power from the NCPC.
But I mean, there were inferences here at other seminar sessions that they were probably getting a pretty sweet deal on that, and that this was a possibility for future conniving on the part of some government body to induce heavy industry to come in here or whatever.
I think there was a good reason for that reading between the lines. I forget who the gentleman was from Yukon Electrical, and they went through their technical discussion about distribution of power and the problems that are faced with it in Yukon. Pointed out how homeowners, especially those with electrical heating, place the greatest demand on the system in the wintertime when there's less power, least power available. But and during, you know, they have peak loads at various times of the day. But mines operate 7 days a week for 52 weeks of the year, and that provides a minimum base load for them. Which works out to great economies. They don't have to have an enormous plant to provide dribbles of power at certain times. At the worst, it fluctuates by just a few percent because the mine consumes most of the power. Reading between the lines from that, and somebody said that they based their cost on their cost, on how much it costs for backing the whole thing right up from when you plug your toaster into their generator. And the fact that they charge commercial consumers more because they have an 8-hour peak demand, rather, and it's even worse than the household consumers. Plus, they pay they can get a tax deduction, but mainly because of that peak. It would seem to me that the heavy mine consumers can just do all the consumer steady rate to get them. They would be a favored customer.
Yeah.
They pay the rent, in other words.
Yeah. They're, you know, if he just implies that it would cost them less to provide electricity to a mine, and that their policy is to pass the savings on to the customer. that's reading between the lines, I know, but even if they don't publish the results, I guess one should be permitted to do that.
I think one major thing about not publishing information like that is that it helps make you kind of suspicious, and it helps in the antagonism almost between consultants and the UConn public.
I would suggest that you rather ask for this information from Ansel. I don't see what advantage it would be to them to consider.
Okay, I think maybe we should do that. Okay.
And there was one point with regards to house heating. We hear a great deal about it. When heating from diesel electric, the efficiency of a diesel electric, it runs around about 32% at peak efficiency. Heating a home with fossil fuel, an efficient system works around from 72 to 85%. Now, no one has brought this up, but when you figure that you're starting to heat your house in Whitehorse and the energy is coming from those diesel engines, you're getting it for pretty near for half price. And that there's been no control or anything put on that, and it's a major thing. If you've got hydro, it would be economic as far as water flowing. But when you're stating fossil fuel, and that's why if we're importing oils, we should look at the furtherance of the Carmex to use that energy in an efficient manner to put electrical energy out.
Of course, the homeowner pays a lot more for fuel oil than NCPC does.
Yeah, but when you start using 32% to 72%, it's not that differential.
I'm saying that the storage is all. You may be using more oil for the same amount. Yeah. But
there's line losses, which is around 5 to 6% too, that are not, that I haven't taken in consideration.
But Charlie, you would also have to spend more on insulating the house if you're going to use.
This is why they're all going to electrical power, because your house insulation costs are only half for electrical as to putting in a hot air or a water system.
Oh, sorry, I thought it was the other way around.
No, just string some wires.
I think it was pointed out though that the most, probably the most economic way to use diesel fuel is to use it in a great big engine and then convert that energy into electrical energy and then just, you know, have the wires going up to our homes and we have it.
You still only get 32% out of your BTU content as to 72% with an efficient home furnace.
And that efficiency would apply to, as opposed to small engines for mechanical work, but for heat work, it's a big difference.
Okay, Raymond,
do you have a comment on the thing about prices? I think last year, as far as I recall, I was working at NCPC for about 3 months, and at a time when the homeowner wanted to pay something like 47 or 49 cents a gallon for heating oil, which is the same as diesel fuel, basically, not very much the same, NCPC was paying 27 cents a gallon,
tax
or something like that. And so that was, so it almost works out to, per final BTU, the same cost to the consumer, whether he gets it, you know, electrically or whether he gets it from oil, just about. Or if you compare those two figures because of the fact that NCPC gets a fuel.
You're speaking about economics, I'm speaking about gallonage used.
Yeah.
The real idea of developing electric power is to prepare for the day when our oil supplies are exhausted. And that's been, we've been telling us that for 10 years. And if we don't heat it, we're going to be in trouble.
How do people feel about that?
Comex coal.
Well, I could refer to the you know, the report done by the Club of Rome, the Minister Growth book. It's quite a popular book. I imagine a lot of people have read it. And all that we're doing is forestalling an ever-increasing calamity. Because as we build up a machinery, a social machinery, to keep us going, that consumes ever more energy to get the same thing done, eventually we're going to run out of rivers. Rivers rivers are a finite resource as well. There's only so many of them. There's only so much coal. And we're only forestalling the day when the crunch hits us. And the more longer we forestall it and go on in the belief that we can dam something here and dig something up there to keep us going, the harder that crunch is going to hit. You know, 30 years ago, if the Arabs had cut the oil off in North America, no one would ever have noticed it, you know? But we're consuming so much so rapidly now, and we're so integrated, that it's becoming ever more important. So, sure, I agree, we shouldn't be burning fossil fuels. It's a waste. It's a crime in itself as well. But hydro is not the ultimate answer.
Hydro is forever once you get it developed.
Yeah, but the thing is, they're not talking about this being something that is solved. They're not talking about one last final dam that's going to be the final cure for Yukon's power needs. They're talking about the first of many. And then search around madly for something else, because this is just the beginning. That's the problem.
Okay, perhaps we could just have the panel quickly run through and give an answer to another question that we thought would be of interest. What do you see in the next 10 years in terms of Yukon development? Maybe we could start up again with Rob.
I don't really know. I think that it sort of depends on what the public wants and how the public makes its opinions felt. But I think that most of us here, the nicest thing about living in Whitehorse is that you can, or perhaps it applies anywhere in Yukon, it's still small. You can still sort of go around town and run into somebody you meet, somebody you know frequently. It's a close community. And if we were to industrialize, we would be, there'd be several thousand, in effect, strangers coming in because, well, the smelter, for example, I don't imagine there's more than a handful of people in the Yukon who would be qualified to work in a smelter, and they're probably already employed. We would be, many, many new faces, and I think that would be a pity. I think that we can keep it as it is, and it will just sort of grow naturally, that people just come up here because they've got, say, relatives up here, or they've got friends up here, or they've just heard about it, or it's a place on the map, they just come, and the place is going to grow naturally that way. But to industrialize, I don't think would be, make it a very pleasant place to live. I'd like to hope that it won't come about, that we won't have a smelter.
Richard?
One of the faults I would have with the NCPC report is their assurance of, even within the wide tolerance that they have in their charts of what they saw as the future. So I could say this, that if I would be almost certain that if the dams were built, if a big dam was built, that it's a foregone conclusion that the power will be used. It will be used by energy. And the reason I feel that's a foregone conclusion is that it will be used because it is being built to provide energy to someone at a rate that they can make a profit. So it goes without saying. The concluding little bit in the NCPC report talks about the long distance future, that is for the year 2000. And they call for a series of dams and utilizing the storage capacity of one to make the next one more economical. So I see this mushrooming, and if this goes ahead, and that's my main concern. I don't think I'd be here tonight if this was a question of one dam, and that's it. We don't have to worry about any more worries about power, or even better, I might even be running around waving a pennant with NCPC written on it if they were going to replace the hydro electricity for the fossil fuel consumption for all time. But the way they've got it pegged is an enormous increase in population in the Yukon, and I would see simultaneous with that, a sort of almost correlated dropping off of the quality of life here, at least the type of life we have now. The other thing is that I don't even see it in terms of economic benefits for the people up here. I don't think that any one individual up here will be any wealthier, maybe a little less well off, because he won't have the enjoyment of the free enjoyment of things that he has now, land and river and etc. But besides that, industrial wages tend to be lower than the wages in the Yukon. That's what we'll have an industrial wage scale. The wages will probably drop. The economics of the boom while the dams are being built, the vast majority of that money is going to be in southern Canada and America, where the equipment is and materials are being purchased from to do it. So that is not $200 million or whatever for the Yukon, very little. So I see it, if the first one goes ahead, I think it's just the beginning. And it's the beginning of a tremendous social upheaval up here, where we've just got to get used to new faces, as Rod said.
Okay, Dave, would you like to comment?
What was the question? I want to comment on something I wanted to say earlier, but I think it's on topic. I think that we're in a real danger of becoming a little naive in this room. We have shelved, I think, a lot of our concerns about this mythical next phase, which is going to tell us all kinds of things. From my point of view, for instance, putting a value on our resources, on our renewable resources that are going to be altered, or in the case of wildlife, obliterated. And I think if you really believe that's going to happen, it will be for the first time ever. And I don't know what we in the Yukon have done to deserve to be the first people to ever have this done for us. I think we should keep that in mind and not just say, well, there's another phase coming and boy, all these things are going to be done for us. So that I see in the next 10 years. Also, I see in the next 10 years the wildlife populations in the Yukon and the wild lands becoming incredibly valuable. I don't think very many Yukoners realize how valuable they are right now, nationally and internationally. And this value is going to skyrocket, because you've got all the only piece that's left that is valuable. It's as simple as that. We already have the nerve to send out on our brochures that tell people to come to the Yukon. To come to the Yukon, here's a picture of a moose, here's a picture of a swan and whatnot. And at the same time, we live in a jurisdiction that hasn't got a single wildlife refuge or virtually no meaningful legislation to protect the habitat that these creatures are dependent upon. So anyway, another thing that I used to sound anyways, it came to me, as we pointed out recently, that how efficient the natural system is in producing the real substance, which is food, which we all need. A hunting and gathering society was compared to a modern society. The beef, the protein that we need, in terms of the calories which go into producing the calorie protein that these people are eating. And hunting and gathering society, in other words, protein that the natural systems produce, can be gotten for 8 calories per calorie. 8 calories of energy goes into procuring for yourself 1 calorie of energy. And a beef feedlot cow takes 15 calories of energy to produce a calorie of food. quoting. I don't know if it's not that. That's all right.
Okay, thank you, Doc.
We have been told that with respect to the immediate future that the Yukon is at a development plateau, and I think that that probably is the case. There are, of course, enormous projects that are being discussed. The pipeline, the Kennedy Valley Pipeline, the Kennedy Valley Corridor in general is one of those. And certainly that is probably an inevitable development in terms of Canadian North. It will occur. It's becoming increasingly obvious that it will not occur immediately. It's going to occur sometime in the future, possibly 15 years, possibly 20 years. So in a 10-year period, and that is going to have an enormous impact on the Yukon, just as the Alaska pipeline to the west of it is having a subtle but enormous impact on the Yukon. There are other indications there that any major mining activity that takes place is going to take place. There is nothing now visible going to take place immediately. And even if it was going to take place immediately, it would still be 5 years or 6 years from today before it started drawing any power from a net. Because that's how long large projects take. It takes 2-3 years to build a very small, it takes 2-3 years for the territorial government, which is a relatively small organization, to get it together to build a shed. It takes the federal government about 4 years to do the same thing. And when you get into massive developmental projects, it takes enormous spans of time to go through the kind of exercise we're going through, getting to the plan, to negotiate the funds, to get the people together to do the engineering studies, and then the actual building itself. Well, look at AJAC, for example, it's a very, very small, minute hydro project. And look at how long it's taking to build. So, the Mackenzie Valley is receding into the future, and there is nothing immediately obvious on the Yukon's horizon with respect to development. So, it looks reasonable to assume that we are, in fact, at a development plateau in the Yukon for a period of time. And that should be kept in mind in some of the decisions we're making about hydroelectric development. Smelters, it's my personal opinion too that I enjoy the style of life I have here, the immediacy and the contact with people. I am aware that industrial development, the development of secondary industry, would pump an enormous amount more people into the Yukon than are here now, and that it would take a relatively small number of people, like 20,000, which isn't very many people, it's not even a small town, to totally alter completely the character of life here. This is 20,000 strangers. In other words, it's one stranger for every one of us. And so that when I looked around at a room like this where I can recognize about 50% of the faces, I don't even be able to recognize 25% of the faces or less.